This week on Making Contact.
My goal right now is to replace the stereotype that Muslims are terrorists with the stereotype that Muslims are hilarious, right? That's my goal.
Comedy and racial justice activism might seem like strange bedfellows, but artists and creative people have always used culture as a tool for social change.
We have to fight in the culture. We don't have any choice. You know, culture is where everybody's at pretty much all the time.
What is the relationship between cultural and political change? On this edition, we'll hear excerpts from a panel on racial justice, culture, and politics, featuring some of today's most insightful and outspoken artists. I'm Jen Chien, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. The 6th annual Facing Race Conference took place in Baltimore, Maryland in November 2012. Facing Race, put on by Applied Research Center, is the largest national multiracial gathering of leaders, educators, journalists, artists, and activists on racial justice. On today's show, we'll listen in on a panel discussion called Culture Trumps Politics, or Does It?, moderated by Applied Research Center's Rinku Sen. On the panel are Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and filmmaker Jose Antonio Vargas, comedian Nagin Farsad, recently named one of the 50 funniest women by the Huffington Post, Lolis Eric Eli, a documentary filmmaker and writer for the HBO show Tremé, and Jeff Chang, award-winning author of Can't Stop, Won't Stop, The History of the Hip-Hop Generation. The panel began with discussion of a quote from Chang, where he posited that cultural change precedes political change.
And, you know, there's all kinds of examples that we could talk about. You talk about Jackie Robinson, you know, coming out in Dodger Blue on the field 7 years before the Brown versus Board of Education decision. You could talk about Ellen DeGeneres coming out on TV all these years before, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell gets repealed. There's just numerous examples. Hip-hop, in a lot of ways, I think we'd all agree, made it possible for us to imagine that there could be a black president. Right. I mean, in 2000, they did a poll of young people, and something like 60% of students of color couldn't even imagine there being a black president. But 8 years later, they were the ones that helped elect Barack Obama. So, you know, we think that if you change the culture, then you have a shot at changing the politics, that politics is sort of the last domino, so to speak.
Moderator Rinku Sen.
I just want to hear from each of you, your broad strokes notion about the relationship between culture and politics. Do you think that they're sequential? And can we start with you, Jose?
Journalist Jose Antonio Vargas.
Yes, I agree that culture, the cultural change happens for political change. But when we talk about culture, I want to kind of unpack a little bit what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, as somebody who's been a journalist for like a decade, and I'm actually working on my second documentary, I think of culture as storytelling. I mean, to me, that's kind of at the heart of culture. And the fact that we have now new technologies, I mean, I remember when Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, kind of like 2005 to 2007, when I was a reporter at the Washington Post, I was drawn to it initially because, you know, having worked in newsrooms my whole life, newsrooms that never reflected the diversity of the people that they cover. I mean, we have a situation right now in which the New York Times finally has a woman editor. And it's like the Nile has like parted. What are they gonna do when they get a Puerto Rican one? You know, it's like, to me, the great thing about, you know, Twitter or YouTube and Facebook is it allows people to tell their own stories, right? And I mean, especially for us, kind of in the undocumented movement and also in the gay movement or any other movement that has always been considered as the other in America, I think we now are all telling our own stories. We are now in charge. We are now playing offense.
Great, thank you. Lolis, let's go to you next.
Writer Lolis Eric Eli.
What's striking to me about political change is that part of what happens is for you to decide to come out, for you to decide to take a stand, there has to be a feeling that there's the possibility of the community reacting, that there's enough feeling, even though people may not necessarily have already put their bodies on the line in this way, you do feel that the society is ready for a kind of change. A big part of that lesson for me was in reading Parting the Waters and checking out the ministers who preceded Dr. King in Alabama and therefore made it conceivable that they might be successful. Mm-hmm. I think in order for the political change to take place, either the political leadership or even the leaders themselves have to believe that they exist in society and will for this change. Also, if you think about the word avant-garde and what that means in military terms,
avant-garde.
What usually happens to avant-garde is they get killed. They go out and they say, okay, this is where we should fight the battle, this is where we should go. They come back, or if they come back at all. But the people who are actually able to take advantage of that information and do something with it are the folks who have the successful movements.
Yeah. So in some ways, you guys are starting to talk about the pre-movement periods, right? So we're really accustomed in our study of history to focus in on those periods where dramatic things happen, where there's spontaneous growing action and replication of action. The sit-ins get replicated everywhere. But before that happens, there's a lot of stuff that goes on. The community has to get consolidated. It has to develop an identity, and it has to do some things together. So there's, we could, you know, one way of thinking about this might be as the pre-movement periods. Nagin, what do you want to say about this?
Comedian Nagin Farsad.
With the stuff I do, I'm not like, there's not a law that I want enacted that says, you know, don't think of Muslims as shitty people. Like, that's not a reasonable law to expect me to get enacted, right? So I don't even give a, I don't care. I was going to say, I don't give a shit. I don't know why I didn't just say that. I don't care. So in some senses, like, I'm not even thinking, I don't care what the political outcome is of the stuff that I do. I care about, I almost only care about the social outcome of what I do. I only care about, like, my goal right now is to replace the stereotype that Muslims are terrorists with the stereotype that Muslims are fucking hilarious, right? That's my goal. And so, which makes the question, directly related, you know, related sometimes.
Jeff, you get the last word on this question.
So this book that I'm working on is called Who We Be, The Colorization of America. And it started out, the way I pitched it, was as a book about the rise and the fall of the multiculturalism arts movement. And I went to my editor with it, and she's like, multiculturalism's got no swag. Who cares about that anymore? And what it turned out was that the book ended up being about the persistence of the culture wars. Why the culture wars never went away. And so I think, like, one of the things that was really interesting to me was that the multiculturalism arts movement, it was a short-lived movement, right? It's really, like, dating between the 70s and then it sort of breaks in the early 90s, and by 93, 94, the wave kind of comes back out, right? So it's short compared to, say, hip-hop, right, as an arts movement. But the notion was after you get the laws changed, after you have de jure segregation removed, like, how are we actually gonna live together, right? And so the culture wars that continue to today are about still these questions. How are we gonna live together? And I think that all of the questions that we've been asking this weekend come to that. We have a view of how people should live together. We believe in integration. We believe in empowerment. We believe in a majority of all, right? And I think that that's in opposition to this notion that was defeated in the last election, that you know, it ought to be an assimilationist type of process, that it ought to be about hierarchies, racial hierarchies, about maintaining these racial hierarchies that date back hundreds of years. And so I think that in that sense, we have to fight in the culture. We don't have any choice. You know, it's culture is where everybody's at pretty much all the time. Mm-hmm. And political change, we think of in terms of events like a judicial decision, like an election, and these kinds of things. But what's all the stuff that's happening outside of that? before that, after that, in the lead up to it, in the middle, all around that, it's happening in the culture. And I think that that's where we need to seriously think about playing and playing hard.
Mm-hmm. Great. So let me ask you all, you know, organizers and activists, people who are trying to push policy, we tend to be, well, we, maybe I shouldn't say we, they, tend to be really transactional about the cultural engagement that our organizations do or have. You know, we just want another way to get out the message that we developed, you know, in the context of making political change. And that can, I'd love for each of you to talk about what kind of advice you would give to organizers who have some inkling that we need other ways to communicate with people, you know, beyond the, you know, straightforward political speech or the broadside, mobilization email. What would you say to people who want to be culturally engaged, but who tend to just end up producing a flyer with their existing slogan in a different font than it had last week?
Writer Lolis Eric Eli.
My suggestion would be that you listen and try to get some sense of how people are already expressing themselves and evaluate to what extent your own vision, your own message is parallel to what people are already saying, what they're already doing. There are a couple of instances in the context of New Orleans culture that were especially powerful for me in the days following the levee failures. It's a story that I have told many times before, so perhaps some of you have heard it. But years ago, a friend of mine was visiting from South Africa, and he saw a second line parade, like the one that my clip ended with.
Mm-hmm.
And, no, I'm sorry, he saw a protest in the city and asked me, where was the dancing? Because in the South African context, there's a toy dancing that accompanies a lot of the political protest. And so he's like, how are these people, these black people, protesting in the absence of this sort of dance? I had no answer. After the levee failures, when people were being told that they could not return to their homes, suddenly the second line parades, which I had never seen as overtly political, became political, became a statement about four people about how badly they wanted to return. And among other things, the signs they held were the signs, the street signs, from the neighborhoods that had been destroyed and that were most likely not to be allowed to return. So in that sense, an expression that had already been a part of the culture had been transformed because it had a purpose at that point, was useful at that point.
Jeff, yeah.
I just want to kind of maybe put a word back into everybody's vocabulary. By the way, I don't think that culture trumps politics, and I would like us to remove the word Trump from our vocabulary. If that's good. Is that good, everybody? Okay, cool. But to insert in place of that, these two words that used to be really, really big, cultural equity. Because we haven't talked about cultural equity for a very long time. We talked about a lot of issues, but we seem to have lost track of this question of cultural equity. And I think that in a lot of ways, folks who used it in the 70s, 80s, and the 90s were talking about questions of access. So access to the tools of creativity, and access to the tools in that sense of transformation, right? Mm-hmm. And then also access for artists to be able to get their work out there. So the other issue was representation, of course, and this led to the culture wars, right? Questions of lack of representation, and questions of misrepresentation. And I think we're in a different era now, right? We've learned, obviously, that more representation isn't necessarily better representation. For instance, the notion of the black president.
Uh-huh.
You all might remember the show 24 that came out, right? 24 was written, actually, by a very right-wing writer, director, producer. But the president was black. Right?
Dennis Hastert.
And this happened in the context of the war on terrorism. So it was sort of this circling of the wagons of, here's an image of a black president during a global war on terror that we're trying to get everybody united around. Like, we make these racial advances during wartime, and it's very related that we would have this particular character being shown at the same time that Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice are the new faces of American militarism, right? So all representation isn't necessarily good representation. We all know that. But if we are able to come back with this notion of cultural equity tied into transformation, right? Individual transformation. So the basic level, being able to make sure that kids have access to the tools of creativity. And yeah, please clap. I want everybody to be into this. And the tools of transformation, community-wide, nationally, globally, if we can talk about cultural equity in that context for this new decade, I think that we'll be able to move a lot further closer to the kind of agenda that we all want to push around this sort of new integrationist ideal and platform.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Because of listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. We now return to a panel discussion on culture and politics taped in November 2012 at the Facing Race Conference in Baltimore, Maryland. Journalist Jose Antonio Vargas spoke next. Vargas, who won a Pulitzer Prize while working at the Washington Post, revealed his status as an undocumented immigrant in 2011.
I remember when I, quote unquote, came out in the New York Times, my next thing is, how do we get on the cover of Time magazine? You know, how do we get on the cover of People magazine? Like, my next thing right now is, how do we get all of the allies that help out people like me? If it wasn't for my high school principal or my editor at the Washington Post who lied for me for 5 years, I would not have stayed at the Washington Post and covered a presidential campaign and won a Pulitzer. How many other editors are out there lying and protecting their coworkers, maybe in a restaurant, at an engineering school, whatever, right? Like, creating those spaces and making sure, and this is why I really believe, you know, I love that phrase, by the way, cultural equity. You're right, Jeff, we haven't heard too much about it. But to me, creating kind of the cultural space in which to be undocumented now, I think has like hit the mainstream. People understand what the DREAM Act is, but now how do we make sure that it's not just about the DREAM Act? Because the DREAM Act, as we know, is just one slice of the pie.
Right.
It's the sexy thing. You know, it's the kids who go to college and speak English well. You know, like, what do we do with most of the people may not? So to me, that's kind of the importance of not just realizing the role that culture plays, but making sure that we're really reaching various audiences and thinking as mainstream as we possibly can be.
Moderator Rinku Sen.
I do want to deal with the question of stories and storytelling. And I'd love Nagin or anyone to talk about the role of humor in that, because people can be very attracted to it and also not, and really fear it.
Comedian Nagin Farsad.
Well, first of all, you know when you're like being held hostage and in the situation where we normally find ourselves, someone with a gun or something, you're like supposed to talk about your family. You're like supposed to be like, my name is whatever, and I've got my sister's name is whatever, blah. And you're supposed to do that. It's like a tactic. I know because I'm Muslim. and just kidding. I'm kidding, guys.
We're laughing.
And it's because, you know, they're gonna have a hard time torturing you or whatever if they like can picture you as a person with a family and like feelings and like that. And that's why stories are effective, because of this weird hostage metaphor that I'm drawing. Because you can really connect to people. And I think with comedy, I mean, here's the thing, like, if you see someone give a lecture or whatever, you may not want to talk to them afterwards, because you're like, I get it, buddy. You already put me to sleep in the room. I'm going to go, you know, have a beer to get over what just happened to me in the minutes I'll never get back. But if you are like you know, if you get to have a good time because of a talk or stand up or story or whatever, and I'm obviously talking about humor here. Like, if you can have a good time, you're gonna. And I mean, whenever I do shows or whatever, like when I did shows where the Muslims were coming, people would always come up and talk to me afterwards. And ask their questions, is they suddenly felt like they could, because comedy is welcoming. It doesn't assume that you are not smart, because I don't need to quote Edward Said when I'm doing stand-up. I don't do that. You know what I mean? And so there's a language of comedy that's like, I'm not smart, you're not smart, let's not be smart together, it's okay. You know what I mean? And so I think that's what like humor does. It kind of like, it makes it okay for you to ask a question. That's all, what's all we wanted when we were on tour. And I have to note, it helps, you know, if you're just like a friendly person, you know, whatever, if you're dressed like a cartoon as I normally am, these kinds of things are make people feel welcome. And so I think that's the end, all I have to say about
great
that.
Great. Thank you. We are heading toward the wrap up, and so I'm gonna put out, are you clapping because we're done? Really? Okay. But so I'm going to put out a last question. You can either address the question or give the audience a last word that you feel like they just, their lives won't be complete unless they hear that from you. So the last question is very practical. What are the skills around art and culture, production, criticism, relation, that you think this Facing Race audience should cultivate among themselves? Whether people think of themselves as artists or not, what are the skills or the attitudes or the like ways of being that you think would be good for this particular movement to cultivate within itself?
Jeff Chang.
I just say for those of us who are thinking seriously about racial justice, just to consider the importance of culture. And to listen to the artists. I mean, I think that in a lot of respects, we haven't necessarily given the artists the kind of depth, the kind of respect, the kind of autonomy, actually. There's a certain amount of autonomy that needs to be given to artists in order to create. And so, you know, I never liked the term cultural worker, because it always presumed, I always heard the term cultural worker in the context of cultural workers follow political leaders, right? And I think that let's reverse that. Let's like think about what happens if culture leads, and what happens if artists lead in certain kinds of situations.
Jose Antonio Vargas.
My friends say that I'm like a walking uncomfortable conversation. And I guess that's probably my main message, is if we can be a little bit more of walking uncomfortable conversations ourselves. And the thing that I deal with mostly is, how do I make sure that I'm really preaching beyond the choir? That's my number one thing that I cannot emphasize more. Meaning that, how do we make sure that we're not just talking to just progressive people all the time?
Lolis, can we go to you next and finish up with Nagin?
Writer Lolis Eric Eli.
What I would say is, folks got to remember that artists don't work for y'all. And it's this whole thing where, you know, your art is supposed to, my art ain't supposed to do nothing I don't want it to do. If it's consistent with what you think it's supposed to be, and if it is useful in your movement, that is your business. If I choose to align myself in the way that some of the artists represented here have chosen to do, and to put their talents in the service of these causes, great. But this notion that art is supposed to do something or to follow your aesthetic, because this is the idea that, well, man, I took art class in second grade. I know it's good art, and that's not good art. Your opinion in that regard is irrelevant. And this notion, art has to serve its own function, be its own master. And then we can decide to what extent it is useful for our purpose, or to what extent this artist represents what we're trying to deal with.
Thank you. Nagin.
Comedian Nagin Farsad.
Thank you guys for warming up for me. stupid. No, I and I feel horrible that I have to say the last thing. But I would say two things. One is don't be angry. Like, don't ever be angry. You're going to get so many stupid questions. I get hate mail all the time. I get shitty people yelling at me, whatever. And the key, I think, in the movement is don't get angry, because that closes people off. And we want to bring people into the fold. And anger is like, just, it doesn't ever work. I've never seen it work. And then the other thing I would say, and this is also something I said earlier today, my parents were like weird about Jews forever, and then we had neighbors move in next door who are totally super Jewish. And they came over one day to introduce themselves, and they brought my parents a rum cake. Now, a couple of words on this rum cake. It was really delicious. Okay. Now, maybe the rum cake was made with the blood of Christian babies. I don't know. But it was delicious enough that my parents, who had been weird about Jews forever, suddenly started loving the out of Jews. And suddenly the discourse changed from like Jews are weird to like Jews are really they have really tight family units, just like Iranians, they would say. And all it took, I swear to God, all it took was a f-ing rum cake. And the last thing I'll say is I don't even need to go to that level to get a story. This guy right here, I used to be homophobic in high school, and now I'm begging for Jose's attention. Why? Why?
I swear to God, I want to marry you. I really want to marry you. I'm so in love with you. No, I totally am.
Because in college, my freshman year of college, my next door neighbor was gay, and one night we got wasted together. And then I was like, wait a second. Gay people are super fun. And literally overnight, I went from, you know, being homophobic to being a fag hag. So it's these small gestures have such a huge impact. Bake your rum cakes. Go out and get wasted with people you don't know. And together we'll change the world.
Give this panel a round.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've been listening to a panel discussion on culture and politics taped in November 2012 at the Facing Race Conference in Baltimore, Maryland. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 or check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Andrew Stelzer and George Lavender, producers, Irene Flores, web editor, Lisa Bartfi, Salima Hamarani, and Aaron Mathewson, production interns, and Barbara Barnett, Dan Turner, and Alton Bird, volunteers. I'm Jen Cheehan. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.